I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk, coming up to compete or cooperate. As Ofcom finally delivers its report on the future of public service broadcasting, we discuss all the fallout from this week's Oxford Media Convention. Does the future of Channel 4 really rest in the coffers of the BBC? Also in the podcast...
Once you start cutting journalists and you have worse products, people are less likely to advertise. So that economic model of high profit levels and huge indebtedness, I believe, for all media companies is over, and they need to find new economic models.
The NUJ's head honcho Jeremy Deer tells us about tough times for the Fourth Estate and the dangers of commoditising the news. Plus, we'll bring you the latest rumblings from the Evening Standard newsroom as its Russian takeover is completed. And
my next guest is a fellow chat show host and the doyen of daytime TV, a man who brings joy to pensioners and the housebound.
Where were we indeed? We look ahead to Wassey's return. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Who says we never get out of London? This week we've come a full hour's train ride away from Paddington all the way to Oxford. Sadly, we're not going to experience very many dreaming spires today. I can see the rather dreary conference venue from here. I suppose the best we can hope for is a decent row.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Well, it feels rather like the last battle of the Hundred Years' War. The media regulator Ofcom has published its final word on the future of public service broadcasting. Although final words would probably be more accurate, there's 124 pages in this report and still no clear conclusion. But the debate seems to have coalesced around two issues: what to do about Channel 4 and how not to kick the legs from under the BBC in the process. Ofcom reckons there should be a second strong provider of public service broadcasting alongside the BBC, and that Channel 4 should probably be at the heart of it. But Channel 4 has convinced the regulator that its funding model is bust. And while Ofcom didn't make a clear recommendation, it's obvious that some kind of tie-up with BBC Worldwide is top of the agenda. Anyway, the trouble is, a parallel process has emerged. Gordon Brown appointed a former Ofcom chief executive, Stephen Carter, now a broadcasting minister, to do his own report. That's due out next week. And the broadcasters are now furiously lobbying ministers, who will ultimately have the final say. All of which has left the current Ofcom boss, Ed Richards, somewhat bemused. How do you feel, Ed Richards, about the parallel process that now seems to be going on with the commissioning by Gordon Brown of a report from Stephen Carter about this very issue that you've worked so hard on?
Extremely relaxed.
Really?
Extremely relaxed.
Looks like there's a row brewing rather nicely there. So, everything seems to be coming to a bit of a head now. I asked the Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham, when we could expect some action.
In weeks. That's true. And under any scenario, I'm sure you know Stephen well, he doesn't mess around, he knows what he thinks, and he will now work to that timetable, and I'm confident that at that point we'll just have to call it as we see it.
If commercial broadcasters, public service broadcasters are in trouble, why should the BBC fund, or BBC Worldwide, be called upon to help them?
Well, that's the question I set. You know, where does the greater public interest lie? Is the public interest in having a range of voices most, or is it in always having a stronger main public service broadcast? And that's a fair choice, and people will take different views. My judgment is that is it actually good for the BBC to have other voices in the mix, and it's healthy for a broadcasting system. My judgment is that we seek to preserve that as a priority, and to do that, I believe further value can be unlocked. And I'd say this phrase again, I'd just maybe underline this phrase from my speech. You know, if you can put partnership in the DNA of the BBC, I think that would be a really good thing.
So that's the line from the government and the regulator. Meanwhile, the chairman of the BBC Trust, Sir Michael Lyons, sounded a bit like a cashier at a bank in the middle of a raid, pleading with Robert Burnham to put the gun down.
BBC Worldwide is part of the BBC. It's an integral part of the BBC. Its umbilical cord leads directly to the quality and creativity of BBC programme making. And so here, if we're looking at how you might build partnerships with Worldwide that create new value, everybody can gain. That has to be the direction that our energies go. At the end of the day, BBC Worldwide belongs to licensed fee payers, and they must be satisfied that there's no loss of value in any new proposals.
Well, it's about time we got to the heart of this now. Joining me is the Media Guardian columnist and Channel 4 biographer Maggie Brown, and in the spirit of Public Service Broadcasting Corporation, Steve Hewlett from the BBC's media show.
I think, by the way, that means not being paid by either side.
That's right. It's quite clear, isn't it? It's quite become quite clear today that some kind of tie-up between BBC Worldwide and Channel 4 is top of the agenda.
I think it's highly likely. And it's more than likely, it won't be the full-on merger that Channel 4 wanted, but it'll be more than the sort of slightly peripheral, let's just help each other out sort of collaborations that the BBC started with. It's quite likely to be a UK-based joint venture, which would include, if they can pull it off, full ownership for the joint venture of UK TV channels, Dave, etc., BBC magazines, anything left in books and other forms of publication, Channel 4 events. So all UK-based operations.
What, Maggie Brown, what do you think that means for Channel 4? It's kind of the end of an era, really, isn't it?
It is the end of an era. And this is why, in a way, I feel quite sad about this, because although it may indeed provide Channel 4 with the kind of money that it's looking for to plug its so-called gap, it does mean, really, that Channel 4's lost control of its future. If this takes place, it's perfectly likely that there'll be a complete reform of Channel 4's constitution. And in an odd way, the contribution Channel 4's made to broadcasting for the past 26 years is by being itself, by being almost under the radar, of being mischievous and being allowed to get away with quite a lot of kind of programming that it just wanted to do.
I'm not sure that the relationship, this deal with Worldwide, is the end of the story for Channel 4. I think the tragedy here is, although goodness knows how it would have happened had the political pressure that Channel 4 has generated over the years not been there, but this deal with Worldwide could generate quite a lot of revenue for Channel 4, which could help to plug their gap. The thing that's going to do for Channel 4 is the creation of this new public service broadcaster that's at the heart of Ofcom's proposals, which they expect to be part financed by this kind of arrangement with Channel 4. So, in an ideal world, Channel 4 would have ended up with this kind of deal with BBC Worldwide, helping to finance its own operations, without the requirement to be bundled into some broader, bigger public service broadcaster that's going to have new remits, new accountability. That's the thing that worries me. I mean, I agree with you about what Channel 4 has delivered. But
because the debate, as it's been framed, unfortunately, by the leaders of Channel 4, has actually raised the whole issue about where they're positioned and what they're doing. And this has led into this clear belief that they can't go on the way they are, that they had to have a very different kind of governance, and that they're going to be under the very watchful eye. I mean, remember, to change the status of Channel 4, you probably have to go through Parliament.
Because Channel 4's remit is in the Communications Act.
Yes.
So imagine what's going to happen, Channel 4's remit, when it gets into the House of Lords committee rooms. Well, I'll tell you what, brass eye, it's not.
Now listen, one of the other interesting aspects of all of this is the shadowy figure of the broadcasting minister, former chief executive, Stephen Carter. I mean, I don't know what Ed Richards thinks about all of this. Well, Ed Richards says publicly he's perfectly relaxed about all of this, but it's quite clear that Carter, that the agenda's with Carter, isn't it?
Well, look, the agenda's, in fairness to Ed Richards, the agenda's with the government, and they always said, and it was widely known, that at some point this would happen. I mean, I think it probably is a little bit difficult to have your ex-boss suddenly turning up, in the guise of your ex-boss, but who also authored the first, for whom you authored the first PSB. Anyway, so look, I'm sure there are some issues here, but I mean, somebody, a very senior Ofcom board member, actually told me on Monday night that they were all running around like he described it as, well, I was going to say headless chickens, but that probably overstates the case. The point is that this review's been written, and rewritten and rewritten, partly in order to make sure that they don't publicly say anything that Stephen Carter's review for next week will disagree with.
Well, you see, you have to remember...
So it is coordinated.
Ofcom, though, is really restricted to broadcasting, and Carter's got this huge Digital Britain thing, which includes broadband and everything else. One further point, though, perhaps I'm being too negative, because if the deal with the BBC is possible, if this joint venture is possible, it means that Channel 4 and Channel 5 merger at this point looks off the agenda.
I don't agree. What Burnham says is let BBC Worldwide first. He didn't say, so don't bother with 4 or 5. Now, consider the potential of this joint venture. If it were to have in it Channel 5, all Channel 5 spin-offs, as well as UK TV, and effective management of Channel 4 and Channel 4 spin-off channels. That would make it a UK-based channel operator of real scale. Now, I'm not very good with arithmetic, and I'm not an accountant, but theoretically, the numbers involved in that, I mean, part of the recession, numbers involved in that in terms of savings and synergies could be really, really significant.
And the turnover could be approaching £2 billion.
So I think that the Channel 5 idea looks rather more attractive in financial terms if you've already got this kind of thing in place.
Do you think that all of this has taken so long, there's been so much talking, and in many ways, the broadcasting industry, the regulators and all the self-interest groups here have talked us all into this. Did it need to happen?
Something needed to happen. What has happened, though, is the recession and this complete collapse of advertising. So it's made people just reach almost for a deal as fast as they can. The worry is whether this is the right deal and if it will be constructed properly.
I think broadly, something like this did need to happen. Ofcom's analysis, most people broadly accept the analysis. The most worrying aspect of this to me isn't the attempt to kind of sort out local news. That's all quite exciting. You know, news in the nations and regions, actually some of that's quite exciting, could generate really interesting things going forward. The thing that really bothers me about this is what's happened to Channel 4, and it's about the way they've positioned themselves, right? By positioning themselves as the key to public service competition with the BBC, which, by the way, they never were. They were a very particular thing, a kind of cultural irritant that made a massive contribution to British broadcasting. That's the thing, and he's done it in all sorts of genres. And, you know, it's from Big Brother to Brass Eye to Dispatches. They've done things which really upset people and really changed our culture. That's the really distinctive thing that you can't afford to lose. This is not to do with how many hours of news, how many hours of current affairs, how many hours of this and how many hours of that. And that's where Channel 4, unfortunately, has now put itself.
Steve Hewlett and Maggie Brown there. Now, in his speech here at Oxford, Ed Richards acknowledged that his report comes in the middle of a serious economic downturn. Still, these debates sometimes seem a million miles away from what's really happening. Jeremy Deer, the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, was in Oxford to give everyone a bit of a reality check.
There's two things coming together. There is the recession, which all advertising-driven media are suffering from, and there is a structural change happening in the industry as more people get their news online rather than from more traditional media, whether newspapers or TV. As a result of those two things, the economic model for a lot of these media is collapsing, and that's resulted, certainly in the last 3 months, we've catalogued 500 journalist job losses, but thousands of media job losses, the closure of 55 newspaper titles, 45 newspaper offices, and every single day at the moment we're getting announcements of more redundancies of journalists, and the scale seems to be between 20 and 25% roughly in different companies, irrespective of the size of the company, going from national newspapers to local newspapers to ITV local news, 429 jobs going there. So it's a real crisis.
So does that mean, in your view, that the economic model for local news is finished?
I believe so. I believe it was always unsustainable, and short-term decisions were being made. And we described it as the subprime newspaper market, where people went out and they bought things. For example, Johnston Press buying The Scotsman for a grossly inflated price, saddling themselves with loads of debt, now having to pay that debt back, unable to do it by increasing advertising or sales of papers. Therefore, the only way they can do it is to cut costs, and the costs that they can cut are journalists, which goes into a spiral of decline. Once you start cutting journalists and you have worse products, people are less likely to advertise. So that economic model of high profit levels and huge indebtedness, I believe, for all media companies is over, and they need to find new economic models. That's the hard part.
So is the new economic model Russian oligarchs taking over local newspaper groups? What do you make of that?
I mean, clearly we don't yet know all the details of it, and we've asked for a degree of transparency and for it to be looked into, exactly what the conditions of that sale and everything are. But whoever is taking over or running local newspapers, there has to be a commitment to investing in quality editorial. And when Andy Burnham talks about local media consortia and running new local media operations, that's what we're trying to get at in the question I asked him and in the conversation we want to have have with him is there has to be a certain level of investment, there has to be a certain level of reinvestment of the profits, so you can't just take massive profits out of local communities, because these should be about serving readers, viewers, listeners, the eyeballs on your website, not just about serving the shareholders and accountants. There has to be a balance struck between those two things.
So I guess what you're talking about is you're asking for news organisations and media owners to regard their operations in a different way. You're looking for a change of culture.
We're certainly looking for a change of culture, but there are some organisations who won't want that change of culture. Fine, they can carry on with their model, but we think that there should be other models alongside these, which is where we're interested in looking at this idea of local media consortia or whatever it might be called. It's trying to encourage new entrants into local media markets, whether online or broadcast or broadband TV, community media. We think there is space for so much more media because technology allows it, but the economic models that they've been have put people off. If the big corporations want to carry on running their media the way they do, then fine. No one can stop them doing that. That's their choice. What we're saying is give local people an alternative and look at alternative economic models.
Jeremy Deer there. Now, if you excuse me, I've got a train to catch.
Service for London Paddington, calling from Reading now, Paddington only. As usual, it's a busy train this evening. Two things I would ask if you're standing.
Well, it's good to be back on Terra Firma here in the studio. Of course, you can read plenty more comment and analysis about the action from the Oxford Media Convention at mediaguardian.co.uk. But right now, I've been joined by Media Guardian's press and publishing correspondent, Stephen Brook, to go through the rest of the week's media stories. You did a noble job filling in for me last week, Brookie. Thank you very much.
Oh, shucks.
Sorry, you're back on the other side of the table now, but there we are.
I don't mind a downgrade.
Now, the one thing we should pick up on, of course, which is the big story you discussed last week, was the sale of the Evening Standard to that Russian billionaire, whose name I can't quite pronounce.
Alexander Lebedev I'm sticking with.
You know him better than I. The sale's gone through now.
It has, finally.
Finally, yeah. But one interesting aspect of it is that I hadn't really picked up on from the coverage is that the London Light, which is the free newspaper offshoot of the Standard, is staying with Daily Mail and General Trust. How is that going to work, and why has that happened?
Well, after Media Guardian broke the story that Lebedev was interested in the Standard, Associated put out seemingly a very innocuous press release saying that the ad sales department from London Light and the Standard were going to separate out, and that the London Light advertising sales would be with Metro, whereas previously they'd been with London, with the Standard. London Light had been joined. Aha, we thought, is this a sign of the two businesses separating out? So it appeared. But what is not happening is that the editorial is not separating out, and this is all very confused at the moment
because quite a lot of the copy, the stories from the London Evening Standard appear in London Light
in a cut-down version. Yeah, and apparently this is an arrangement that is going to stay.
Well, that's very curious, isn't it? Because you would have thought that London Light would be a competitor to it is a competitor to the Evening Standard, and Lebedev and his lot wouldn't want to have anything to do with it.
Exactly. In fact, I spoke to one executive who was astonished by this run of events, because it looks like Lebedev has bought this 75% share in the paper, and one of the main competitors and drain on the Standard sale, London Light, which has so much of the news stories repurposed in this free sheet, is going to stay. We've been told that Lebedev is going to set up a board of various luminaries that are going to be an editorial control board for the Standard. And Associated and Paul Dacre, who was the editor-in-chief, is not going to be involved. Yet, London Light is still going to take all its copy from the Standard, and they're still going to have this joint newsroom arrangement, which is complicated if you think about it, because if you're Associated and you're running London Light and you don't like the radical new direction that Lebedev takes the Standard in, if indeed he does that, but he's made signs that he wants to, what do you go and do if, you know, you now have no control over your main source of news?
And in any case, the London Light is loss-making, so there's no, I wouldn't have thought there's much question of them hiring their own reporters or anything like that, is there?
I don't think so. Although, to be fair to Associated, they've always said this is a five-year plan. Mm. Get the Russian illusion there. Right. With London Light, and yes, that they're quite happy for the losses to continue, but they think that it's going to be a good business eventually, and they made a great success out of Metro, which, you know, makes about 8 million quid a year, pre-media downturn it did.
Right, cool. The other aspect, the other interesting tidbit of gossip around all of this, of course, is that, which I hadn't really realised until I waded through all the copy, was that Geordie Gregg, editor of Tatler, has been lined up as the new editor of the Evening Standard, and Lebedev are old chums.
Yeah, indeed, and Lebedev has featured quite glowingly in the pages of Tatler and has organised all these charity functions, including one with Mikhail Gorbachev. Lebedev's son, Evgeny, is also friends with Geordie, and in fact, very quietly, and the FT reported on this, in December, they set up this new company called Evening Press, where Evgeny's the director and Geordie Gregg is a substantial shareholder. Oh. So we're all expecting a very big announcement very soon about Geordie Gregg, but last time I checked, he had not, in fact, resigned from Tatler and was still preparing the April cover issue.
Well,
it
all sounds very chummy. We'll wait to see what happens. The other story that's around this week is the return, of course, of Jonathan Ross.
Yes.
With we understand, four specific words. Can you remember what they are?
So, where were we?
Exactly. And he has made an apology, hasn't he? But I mean, the BBC News Channel seem to be obsessed by this story. They spent most of the end of this week going on about it. Is it
that was
really
hilarious.
A big deal?
Failing, I should just say, to get a reporter actually into the studio.
Oh, this was the funny thing.
To hear what Jonathan Ross had to say.
The BBC banned the BBC from the from the recording. But a rival news organisation managed to get in.
Yes, Sky. Sky News, which some people say is somewhat brasher than the BBC, their reporter Ender Brady turned up, bought a ticket from someone in the line.
only £100.
Yeah, cheap, you might think. Got to the front of the queue, security said, "Sorry, sir, audience seats are full, you can't come in." So he put on his best Irish accent and said, "I've come all the way from Ireland to see Tom Cruise."
Ender Brady doesn't have to really put on much, but he's got an Irish accent.
He thickened it up, though, didn't he? And then they stuck him in some overflow room with a giant big telly that he could report. Well, he could see everything that went on and then come out and report, and very generously told the waiting media pack out there, Guardian included, what had gone on.
Good for him.
Will you be watching Ross? That's my question. Well, I'm not, because I'm going to the pub. It's Friday night.
It is Friday night. I don't. We can watch him on catch up, obviously, on iPlayer.
Is it a professional dereliction of duty if we don't watch Jonathan Ross, Matt?
I'm sure someone will watch. Someone from Media Guardian. They'll probably be live blogging it on Media Guardian.
Of course they are. I must say, I probably will be listening to the radio program on Radio 2.
I have enjoyed his stand-ins.
Well, yeah, I have too. And the only reason I find myself listening to it is that it comes after the excellent Sounds of the 60s, which was on at 8 a.m. on Saturday morning.
Is this Elaine Page's program, which I know you're a big fan of?
No. This is Brian Matthew, my goodness, who actually says, you know, it's just basically lots of requests from the 60s until you realise that he actually was there in the 60s as a DJ and knows all the people whose records he's playing.
We should also mention that police cuts are biting deeper, aren't they?
Oh, yes. The bill is being cut from 2 one-hour episodes a week to 1 hour. One-hour episode a week, which actually was way back 26 years ago how it originally debuted on ITV.
So it's back to the future.
So it's come full circle. So it's going to be half the number of episodes, but ITV are promising. It's moving to a later time slot, so it's going to be post-Watershed.
It's all going downhill from here, isn't it?
Well,
being at the end of the bill, I think.
No, I have copped so much flack for daring to reveal that I actually watch the programme. And B, really like it. But everyone in Australia loves the bill. And I think this, you know, you could say this is just cuts, blah, 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 but we're actually dressing this up.
It's drama cuts. It's ITV drama cuts.
But it could be an opportunity to take it in a new direction.
Well, we all love a man in uniform, don't we, Stephen? That's it for this week. To give your feedback on anything you've heard, do leave a comment on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or head to the Facebook wall. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.